listening to Vermont Edition. I'm Michaela Lafrac. You might have seen Alzheimer's disease in the headlines over the past few months after the FDA approved a controversial new drug that claims to treat Alzheimer's. One of the reasons the story got so much attention was that there aren't many treatments available for this disease that destroys memory and other mental functions. Most Alzheimer's patients are over 65 years old, but there are people who are diagnosed much younger, in their 50s, 40s, even 30s. They have what's called younger onset or early onset Alzheimer's. They face unique challenges in accessing care, managing work and finances, and dealing with social stigma. Their family members often aren't prepared to become full-time caregivers. Here in Vermont, around 13,000 people are estimated to be living with Alzheimer's. One of them is Pamela Smith of Middlebury, Vermont. She was diagnosed a few years ago in her early 50s. Pamela and her daughter, Erin, will be joining us in just a few moments. But first, I'd like to bring onto the air Meg Polite. She's the public policy director for the Vermont chapter of the Alzheimer's Association, which supports research into treatments and advocates for people living with the disease. Meg, welcome to the program. Hi, Meg.
Thank you.
Are you there?
Thank you for. I'm here now. Thanks. Thanks for having me and for doing this show on this important topic.
No problem at all. We're glad to have you on our air. First, I would like you to clear up one thing for our listeners: the difference between Alzheimer's and dementia. Can you explain that for us?
Sure, that's a great question. So dementia is really a general term for decline in mental ability, and Alzheimer's is a specific disease that is one of the forms, the most common form of dementia. So they are both the same thing, but Alzheimer's is the specific form of a dementia, and it accounts for 60% or more of the cases of folks with dementia.
And who is typically affected by Alzheimer's?
Well, I think the short answer would be everybody, because once a person has Alzheimer's, of course, there's so many other people that are impacted by that, including their family members, as in the guests you have today, the daughter caring for a mother. It could be a spouse. It could be a caregiver. It is true that women are more likely to have Alzheimer's. About 2/3 of people with Alzheimer's are women, but it does really impact everybody.
And BIPOC people of color are also more likely to get it than white people. Is that correct?
That's true. They are. There is research that's showing that people of color are about twice as likely to have Alzheimer's or other dementias as older white people, and really trying to dig into the reasons that is the case.
Now, today we're focusing specifically on younger onset Alzheimer's, when people who are younger than 65 are diagnosed with the disease. Can you talk to me a little bit about how they are diagnosed, what the challenges are in being a person that is, facing a disease that most people experience later in their lives?
That's a fabulous question. And I think that there's, just to be clear, there's challenges for people of all ages in receiving diagnosis for Alzheimer's and other forms of dementia. And one of the key focuses of the Alzheimer's Association is really to increase awareness around this, both amongst the general public and among providers, so that diagnoses can happen more quickly, because that's often the first step in accessing resources. And I think that the challenge for younger people is that many primary care physicians and other folks in the medical industry who they're interacting with, because this is very rare for people under the age of 65, it's just not on the forefront of what they're looking for. And so there's a lot of work to be done. And we're really lucky here in Vermont that we have a really active and engaged group of people through the Department of Health that are really working with providers to educate and re-remind them of the signs of Alzheimer's and dementia across all age spectrums, so those diagnoses can happen, quicker.
One of the Vermonters you mentioned who is living with early onset, younger onset Alzheimer's is Pamela Smith of Middlebury. She was diagnosed just a few years ago in her early 50s. Pamela, welcome to Vermont Edition.
Thank you. Thanks for having me and my daughter.
Yes, we're also joined by Pamela's daughter, Erin McElhaney-Smith, who at 30 years old is her mother's primary caregiver. Welcome, Erin.
Thanks for having us.
Now, Pam, before we start talking about your diagnosis, I'd like our listeners to get to know you a bit better. Before you started experiencing the effects of Alzheimer's, what did you do for work?
I've had lots of jobs, but all generally in the mental health caregiving field. So I was a crisis worker for 18 years. I was a licensed clinical social worker. So I was a therapist, mostly working with children and families. Most recently, I worked for the state of Vermont as a public guardian. So a guardian for adults with intellectual disabilities or seniors over the age of 60 who were in need of a public guardian.
Now, tell me a little bit about when you first started to notice that something didn't feel quite right about your health.
Well, the first signs I would say were just I was having memory problems. You know, not able to remember visits, not remembering conversations. And I had been a person who had a pretty superior memory up till then, auditory memory. So that was quite disconcerting. I noticed I needed to, you know, get everything in my calendar and was needing to take much more detailed notes and make sure I wrote down everybody who was in a meeting because I wouldn't remember that later. And that just kind of grew. I noticed that people around me were starting to make accommodations. You know, I was a supervisor and the people that I supervised would sort of tell me a little bit about the client before they told me the situation, I think, because they realized I wasn't remembering their caseloads in detail. I don't know. I think the kids made jokes once in a while. It was sort of bit by bit.
Erin, what was your experience at this time? What did you think was going on with your mom?
Her Alzheimer's coincided with her menopause a little bit. Yeah. There was some overlap. And there's now coming out with studies around the effects that menopause can have on mental health and memory and anxiety. So there were a lot of assumptions that those two things were linked from her PCP and from family. The first thing I noticed in her that was different for me was her anxiety, because my mother historically was the world's calmest human, sometimes like almost destructively so, like sometimes not panicking when maybe she ought to. And then she became someone who like gets stressed out because the kids are too loud. I have two small kids. Or something didn't go quite the way she thought it was going to, and suddenly she's anxious about it, which was a very big change. And I think I still sometimes kind of forget and have to remind myself that it's normal now.
I think that all of us, including my primary care provider, were thinking like anxiety and depression was causing the memory loss. And in hindsight, I think it was very much that my constant fear of not knowing what I was and wasn't going to remember was making me really anxious. It taking a lot longer for me to do writing was making me really anxious because I was losing my sense of time. That's anxiety producing. So there were just a lot of things that the Alzheimer's was causing that was causing anxiety but everybody around me was thinking anxiety was causing the memory problems.
Now, I'm wondering, Pamela, if you can explain to us what the process that you went through in receiving an accurate diagnosis. Because from my understanding, it took a very long time to figure out what you actually needed to receive care.
Yeah, so it was about 2 years of me seeing my provider about every 3 months for other medical issues. About 2 years of me saying, no, something's really wrong in my memory. And then one day at work, I used to be a very fast writer. I was really struggling to write a note that should have taken me 15, 20 minutes. And I looked up at the clock and I'd been working on it for 4 hours. And I had, you know, a bit of a crying meltdown that something was really wrong. And I called my doctor's office and my regular provider wasn't available. And another doctor offered to come in and see me early the following morning. And then he listened to sort of this collection, you know, people would ask me to describe, well, like what? And I would say something and they're like, oh, everybody forgets how to spell scissors or whatever. But he really listened to the whole thing. And he said, no, I think something is wrong. And then he ran lots of labs and they came back quite good. He was very generous and called around to try to find a neurologist who would see me more quickly than 6 months away, which is what everybody was telling him. So I got in to see a neurologist. The next step was going to the memory clinic to get a very thorough, like hours and hours long memory assessment.
And we'll hear from somebody later in the program who works with the memory clinic as well.
Great. So I got the results back from that and saw that my IQ had dropped 140 points. I mean, had dropped 40 points. So that was quite alarming to me, said something was really wrong. He then got me in to see a neurologist. The neurologist said I had mild dementia. Everybody kept on not wanting to tell me the full story, which was hard. Each person, medical provider, said the next one would tell me how to interpret the results. I don't know if it was nobody wanted to give me bad news or I don't know what that was about, but it was hard because it was prolonging things. And yet it became very apparent I could no longer work. I didn't want my judgment being questioned. So I'm wrapping up work. And then eventually I got in with Dr. Pendlebury at the memory clinic, and he's who finally went over all the materials and said, no, you do have early onset. I had to ask, what do I have? And he said, you have early onset Alzheimer's. And so from there I could apply for disability and start dealing with what I have.
I'd like to share the experience of another person with younger onset Alzheimer's, the journalist Greg O'Brien, who lived in Cape Cod. He was diagnosed when he was 59, and he was profiled by NPR just a few years ago. And he discussed in that series how he told his children about his diagnosis. Let's take a listen.
How do you tell your kids that they got Alzheimer's? It sucks. I had planned this family meeting, so all the kids are home, and we're going to go out to dinner. I'm in the bathroom. I felt a little bit like Luca Brasi in The Godfather practicing my speech, you know, on the day of your daughter's wedding. And so I could hear, Daddy, where are you? So I came out and, went over the fact that their great-grandfather, my grandfather, had died of Alzheimer's, and my mother, which they knew, and now it's come for me. And they were stunned. They didn't quite know what to say. And Connor kind of cut through it. And he says, so, Dad, you're losing your mind. And everyone laughed. And I laughed. And I said, you know what? That's enough talk for today. Let's go to dinner. And that's what we did. And we started talking about the Boston Red Sox and the Patriots and the Celtics. And I felt more comfortable in that.
That was the journalist Greg O'Brien talking about his experiences, first telling his children about his diagnosis. Now, Aaron, I'm wondering how you feel listening to that. Has humor helped your family cope with this disease?
Definitely. We have a sometimes morbid sense of humor, and we utilize it quite a lot. I think my kids have started also, because we had to have a family meeting to tell the children eventually. And we used some therapists that we knew, and it went really well. But yeah, we joke a lot. We definitely have days where it's like we can cry or we can say something incredibly inappropriate and laugh. And we typically go with the latter because it's just too hard to cry that many days.
Yeah. The kids now start everything they say to me with, you might not remember this,
yes,
but
my children have definitely adapted well to the idea that she might forget.
Yes. Kids do seem to adapt much quicker than the adults sometimes in our lives. I've certainly noticed that. I have one more clip to play from Greg O'Brien about how his son reacted later on to his diagnosis. Let's take a listen.
So, about a week later, we had a family outing in Coronado Island, and I had just basically assigned my son to be my guardian should something happen to Mary Catherine and made him power of attorney. So I said, we need to talk about this, and he didn't want to. He wanted nothing to do with the discussion. So I said, okay, I'll be right back, and I went inside, and I got 80 pages of medical notes that talked about my diagnosis, and I said, Brendan, you need to read it. I don't want to read it, he said. So I started reading it, and he started yelling and screaming. I don't know what words I can use here. He started saying, bullshit, bullshit, bullshit. And then he said, expletive, bullshit. And I said, Brendan, you need to get this. He grabbed my medical records, tore them up, and threw them off the balcony, and then turned to me and said, Dad, it's bullshit because I know it's true. Excuse me. He put his head in my chest. Here's this guy now in his late 20s, and he cried like a little boy.
That's a difficult piece of tape to hear, I'm sure. And Aaron, I'm wondering if you could take a moment to reflect and respond to that as somebody who is young, is 30, and is now in the position of being a caregiver for a parent.
Yeah, I understand his son's mentality. I am and my mom, we're both planners. So we did the opposite. Like, what paperwork do we need to sign? Your husband can't be in charge of these things. So how do we make it clear that we need to, like, doctors need to skip over the husband and go to the daughter, which isn't expected. I do have a brother who can't handle certain things. So we definitely have to censor. He's aware of his limitations in taking in information. So between himself and us, we're able to censor him from some of the worst of it. He's my older brother. So again, making it clear that we need to skip over the expected caregivers and come down to me, because that's just the way our family needs to work to get through the day.
But we immediately went to the lawyer, got the will done, yeah, did the advance directive, got that filed. Did the power of attorney.
Did the Colst form.
got me on the
bank account.
Yeah.
We did the opposite of what his family had of, like, okay, so instead of talking about how we feel, what do we need to do?
Right.
Which is funny, being the child of a therapist, that's the way we take it. But it definitely is. We talk about our feelings as little as we can while still expressing our love, and just focus on what needs to be done, which for my mother and her mental health has included this new source of advocacy.
I think my husband's response was, I think my husband's response is closer to that son's response.
Mm-hmm. Of feeling rage or anger.
And
denial.
And I don't want to hear this, you know, you seem, you're fine. Except then the switch eventually flipped and it was tremendous sadness. But that took a while because I can still speak and I still look the same. You know, it's not like you can tell by looking at me, but, you know, he eventually notices my functioning deteriorate as well.
We're joined now by Dr. William Pendlebury, a neurologist and pathologist and the medical director of the Memory Clinic at UVM Medical Center. Welcome to the program.
Thank you, Michaela. It's a pleasure.
Now, as we've heard from Pam, diagnosing early onset Alzheimer's can be challenging. So when you see patients, have they usually been on the hunt for some sort of diagnosis for quite a while?
Either or. Some people come to the clinic and it's the first time they've sought a diagnosis and have not been working with other practitioners. Other people have been to several providers and have not gotten an answer. And we try to pick up the pieces from that situation and make a definitive diagnosis. So it can go either way.
Now, there's a controversial new treatment out there that was just approved by the Food and Drug Administration in June, and it made headlines as the first Alzheimer's treatment to gain approval since 2003. What exactly does it purport to do, and what is the controversy surrounding it?
So the drug you're referring to is Aduhelm. That's the brand name. The generic name is aducanumab. It's part of one of a class of drugs called monoclonal antibodies, and the mechanism of action of these drugs is after intravenous injection, these antibodies will find their way into the brain, seek out what is considered to be one of the major pathologic causes of Alzheimer's disease, which is a form of amyloid called A-beta 42, and basically sponge the brain and remove as much of the A-beta 42 as possible. We've known about these antibodies for a long time. This is the first one that actually came to the FDA for approval. And it does come with a number of controversies. The first is that the drug was initially evaluated by an FDA advisory panel of experts, and they uniformly gave a recommendation to the FDA not to approve the drug because they did not feel that it showed enough evidence for clinical benefit. The FDA decided to approve the drug anyway, and that occurred on June 7th. And it's important for your listeners to know that the approval was not based on a clinical benefit of the drug. It was based on the biologic effect of removing the A-beta 42, which is unusual for the FDA to approve a drug in which the actual benefit has not been shown conclusively. So the drug is now available. Its price tag is $56,000 a year, which is another controversy.
Wow, $56,000 a year.
$56,000 a year. It has to be given intravenously every 4 weeks for 18 months. And so far, no payers, including Medicare, have agreed to pay for this drug. There is an assumption that Medicare will eventually approve it, but that will probably not happen until March of next year. And even if it does approve payment, there will still be a 20% copay. So patients and families will still be looking at $10,000 to $12,000 a year to take this drug, out-of-pocket expense. And I guess the last piece is that the drug does have side effects, which include brain swelling and microscopic bleeding into the brain. Fortunately, although those sound like horrible side effects, vast majority, greater than 90% of patients have not experienced any clinical symptoms associated with that. But the intravenous infusions do have to be monitored by periodic brain imaging, specifically MRI scans. So there's cost, questionable efficacy, and intensive therapy in the standpoint of a monthly infusion and monitoring with additional x-rays. The last point I would make is that anybody who receives this drug has to be proven to have this rogue protein in their brain, the A-beta 42, so that requires some additional special testing prior to the therapy being initiated.
Meg Polite with the Vermont chapter of the Alzheimer's Association. I wanted to ask you about the high costs of treatment and care that Dr. Pendlebury just alluded to. What are some of the challenges that people with younger onset Alzheimer's specifically might face in paying for care?
So are you asking
me
that?
If he wants to answer, that's perfect.
Meg, go ahead.
He has more experience with it.
Well,
so
Meg, go ahead.
So I think that there's a lot of challenges for people in terms of paying for the challenges associated with dementia and Alzheimer's. And I'm not familiar enough with the different forms of payment to touch on them. But I do think that it's important to note that, there are more than 25,000 unpaid caregivers right here in Vermont who are supporting Vermonters with dementia, and they're providing 36 million hours of unpaid care a year. So while those costs are exceedingly high looking at this new drug, I just think we have to balance that with the costs that are out there on families, on people that can't go to work because they're caring for a parent, and on what that does to our economy and our state as a whole.
Pam and Aaron, I would love to hear your experiences on trying to finance care.
So, yeah, I mean, just one thing that I think people don't necessarily know is when you have early onset Alzheimer's, disability has this section or whatever called compassionate allowance, and early onset Alzheimer's is on it. So a good thing is that our process for getting disability is quite quick. The what people may not realize, though, is that we still don't get Medicare for 2 full years after we get our first check. So, you know, even if Medicare was paying for it, that doesn't help me for at least 2 years. Not that I am a candidate for this treatment anyway, but it's been really challenging. We've made a lot of calls trying to figure out how to get help. We've learned that there isn't really anything. Like, I used to be a case manager working with adults with developmental and intellectual disabilities, and it was a very holistic wraparound kind of service, covered lots of aspects of people's lives. That doesn't exist. The burden is really on the family. There are geriatric care managers that have a very limited role. I can't access that unless I'm on Medicaid. I think most of us with early onset, I mean, my husband's only 46. He can't, you know, and he has child support, and we can't live off of just my disability. So we're not going to qualify for Medicaid financially.
And the only other service is you have to be over the age of 60.
So
65 to access.
Yes.
There isn't a compassionate allowance within our state to provide care for younger people who have an aging disease. So I don't work.
That's, yeah.
I take care of my family. I take care of my mother, and I do have small children. So there are benefits to me and my family for not working, but
and then
I can't manage it.
And then I literally am starting to hire people to help, and I have to pay out of pocket to do that.
Dr. Pendlebury, is part of your position talking to families like Pam and Aaron about how they are going to set up care over, you know, what could be a decade or more?
Well, fortunately, part of the team at the memory program includes two social workers who are experts in the area of education and information around the diagnosis of Alzheimer's disease, whether it be late onset or early onset. So I'm fortunate to have that that addition to my staff, which everybody who has a diagnosis of Alzheimer's disease, regardless of early or late onset, are invited to have a meeting with one of our clinic social workers to begin for planning, including planning for the future with advanced directives, wills, resource availability, and financial opportunities to help pay for this. So we try as best as possible to provide that counsel for all of our patients.
Let's go now to Rob in Lincoln. Rob, you are on the air. Go ahead, please.
Hi, Michaela. First of all, thank you for covering this topic. It's near and dear to my heart, as last Friday was the one-year anniversary of my mom passing away at the age of 68 after, you know, a decade-plus long battle with early onset. So hello to also Pamela and Aaron. We wear the same shoes. I call them the Alzheimer's shoes. And I first want to thank them both for their courage to be out there, outspoken, sharing their story for my family and for myself. You know, it's a disease that you feel so powerless. You know, especially a disease that doesn't have, you know, a silver bullet in regards to a treatment or a cure. And so, being able to share my story and my family's story brought a little empowerment to what feels like a pretty helpless situation sometimes. And a couple of things as I've reflected year over year in regards to wearing Alzheimer's shoes is if folks know someone out there with dementia or know, you know, a family member or a friend that is caregiving for that person, you know, it's not a if I can help, it's a how I can help. And I really encourage folks to change their mindset. And also, I think one thing that really helped us is I call it sort of the proactive win-then plan. And knowing the trajectory of the disease, unfortunately, and the steps that can unfold, instead of saying, if this happens, then we'll do this, it's when this happens, then we'll do that. And that really helped create sort of a groundwork over the decade plus that as my family navigated and my dad was the primary caregiver and I watched the toll that the disease took on him, and we got to the point where we realized, all right, it was time for my mom to go into, you know, a memory care facility in northern Michigan, and that's where she lived out her life. But I do want to say kudos to Pamela and Aaron for your courage, and we live right around the corner from one another, and I look forward to crossing paths and walking this journey together with you. So, again, thank you, Michaela, and I'll take my comments off the air.
Thank you for your call, Rob. We appreciate it. Pamela and Aaron, I wonder if you can talk to me about what it was like to share this diagnosis with your community. Pamela, you chose to make a pretty public announcement at one point. Is that right?
I did. So I told almost nobody for a year and a half. I felt really isolated by the diagnosis. I mean, it's also COVID was going on, so that was a contributor. And in some ways, I felt like ashamed, humiliated. I'd just been, like I said, this competent helper person. And then I some days couldn't do really basic things. So I didn't tell anybody and I sort of hid. And then I decided that was the wrong approach and it was giving up. And that while it's low incidence, I'm not the only one, and that I suspected there were others that were feeling alone and isolated and, you know, a sense of shame for no decent reason. So I decided to tell everyone. I wrote a letter to the editor and published it, it was published in the Addison Independent. And then I also put basically the same posting on my Facebook.
And Erin, what was that experience like for, oh, sorry, go ahead, please.
No, go ahead.
I saw it do excellent things for my mother and her mental health. I didn't take it very well. and we definitely do this thing where we try to hide our harder emotions from each other because we are very connected emotionally and we can impact each other. We're a little too empathetic with each other sometimes. So for her, it was this very liberating. We talked about it like, so I'm queer. So we talked about it like, oh, you came out of your little Alzheimer's closet. And I was very happy for her and remain happy for her. It made it real in a way that was extremely unpleasant for me. Like, instead of it being this family thing that we dealt with on our own, it was owned suddenly by a lot of people. And everyone was allowed to have their reactions. And I'm not on social media, so that helped, I think. But I didn't really want other people's feelings. This whole you're brave thing has always really confused me. Like, I'm not braver because I'm helping my mother. Like, we just got dealt an unfortunate hand. And I've always been confused by that terminology around medical issues, but I got a lot of that thrown at me, and I really hated every second of it.
Let's go now to Judy in North Bennington. Judy, you are on the air. Go ahead.
Hi, I am calling as I've been listening. There are a couple points I want to make. My husband passed away from dementia about a year and a half ago, right at the start of the pandemic. He had been sick for many years. He was a college professor for 45 years. He was a college administrator. It was very hard to see him losing himself. He was on the drug that we talked about that potentially could cause brain swelling and brain bleeds. He got both of those symptoms. We later realized, with the help of a wonderful psychiatrist at the United Counseling Service here, that in fact he did not have Alzheimer's. He had frontotemporal dementia. I'll never know whether the drug affected the speed of his decline because he didn't have Alzheimer's. But I do know that it was very difficult. And I think that people don't understand that there are many forms of dementia, Alzheimer's, of course, being most well known. But other forms of dementia, like my husband's, Ron's, caused delusional thinking, anxiety, depression. And another point is that listening to the doctor from the memory clinic and listening to the services that they had available, the memory clinic here in Bennington offered us no social work services, no wraparound services. Fortunately, he had a wonderful primary care physician who did help figure out drugs that would help to in some way keep him calm. She was wonderful. She would call me at home. She would respond to everything I did. But there weren't a lot of other services available. I think maybe we need to think about the southern part of the state that doesn't have a large research university for helping people like that.
Judy, thank you so much for your call and for raising those points. Meg, what is your organization doing to try to expand the care that is available in all parts of Vermont?
So, you know, the Alzheimer's organization nationally and here in Vermont, and I'm so pleased to have joined not that long ago and to be at the helm now of their policy work as a policy director, really works to make those connections that your caller just spoke about and to make them not only across all parts of Vermont, but across the entire country, so that as we are learning from our partner states and what's happening, we can replicate some of that here. And I think, you know, one of the big things that I want to do in this coming year, and I'm so excited to have Pamela and Erin working with me and so many other people, Rob and others, is really to bring these stories, bring these experiences of both being someone with Alzheimer's, either younger onset or Alzheimer's at any age, or being a caregiver, to light and really to make it real to our elected leaders and policy leaders in the state. And there are so many different issues facing people right now. And I think the most compelling way to make change is for personal connections and for personal stories. And that's really what policy and advocacy work is about. And the added bonus of it, which I hope the advocates feel, and I've heard from them they do, is that it does allow you to be part of a larger community and to share the burden of what you're going through. And as Rob said, to have a little control and to do something impactful when facing a disease that you really can't control and there's not a cure for.
Dr. Pendlebury, do you think most doctors in Vermont, especially primary care providers, are experienced enough with younger onset Alzheimer's to make these early and accurate diagnoses? And if not, what kind of programs are there to educate doctors?
Well, the answer is, I'm a little bit hesitant to put it this way, yes and no. There are certainly pockets of primary care providers in the state. In the state of Vermont, who feel very comfortable and competent to approach a diagnosis of early onset Alzheimer's or Alzheimer's in general. I think the primary care world has been a little bit lacking in attacking this disease from the standpoint of diagnosis and treatment. Some of your listeners may be aware of the fact that we are currently trying to roll out an initiative called Hub and Spokes through a collaboration of a number of stakeholders in the state of Vermont who are working to educate primary care providers throughout the state regarding diagnosis and treatment. As I've told many audiences over the course of 30 years, this is not in general rocket science. It's a careful evaluation that takes time, but can be done by primary care providers. And we'd like to improve and encourage primary care providers' approach to the diagnosis of Alzheimer's disease. One of the things we've done is to create something called Corner Consult with Dr. Pendlebury, which is a volunteer effort on my part to be available on two Wednesdays of the month to do informal consultation with primary care providers about basically any aspect of dementia and Alzheimer's disease. We're doing this by Zoom, but this is only one of the educational efforts that we're trying to bring to the state to try to improve and spread diagnosis and treatment.
Erin, as a caregiver for your mother, what would be the most helpful thing that you could receive either from the state or from your community to help you as you continue to provide care?
I think the biggest thing we've been looking for is some kind of case management. She can't. The social workers are great for an hour or two, and then the rest of our lives go on. We don't have access to them. So I pay her bills and I do all of her paperwork. I go to most of her doctor's appointments because she may or may not remember what the directions were. And if people with cognitive disabilities get this service as part of just being a Vermonter, I don't understand why someone who has Alzheimer's can't get the same services.
Meg, yeah. Is case management something, apologies, I just want to pose this to Meg briefly. Is case management something that your organization is working on expanding?
We are looking at all of these and really working closely, as I mentioned, with the Department of Health. And we do have a grant here in Vermont that we got from the CDC, a national grant. We're one of the first states. It's called the Bold Initiative. And so we're in the process of creating a statewide plan on Alzheimer's and dementia. And that should be released by the middle of next year. And then there'll be it will include these aspects and they'll actually be trackable and measurable ways to implement this throughout the state, and we'll be able to start getting statewide buy-in on it. So there's definitely progress being made.
Now, Pam, I did mean to cut you off there, and I would like to end this conversation with you and your experiences. I'm wondering what, as you walk down this path of Alzheimer's, what brings you joy and comfort?
Right when I got diagnosed, I got two Maine Coon kittens, they're still kittens, but they weigh about 20 and 22 pounds each.
Those are some big kittens.
Some big kittens. I think, you know, I spent a career trying to help people live in the moment, but that wasn't my natural tendency. I'm a planner. I do think it's helped me live in the moment, you know, whether it's with my cats or with my grandchildren or with my husband or watching TV. I can't read anymore. That was a really big loss for me.
Mm-hmm. I'm sorry to cut you off. We are out of time for today, but I am so glad to hear that you have the support of your family and those kittens out there. That was Pamela Smith and her daughter, Erin McElhaney Smith. Thank you for joining Vermont Edition. We are also joined today by Dr. William Pendlebury of UVM's Memory Clinic and Meg Polite of the Vermont Chapter of the Alzheimer's Association.